Hello and welcome to this podcast from RT Radio 1 of Seascapes, presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email seascapes@rte.ie. Hello, welcome aboard this edition of Seascapes, your maritime programme. In this, the last programme for this memorable year. Hear from members of the Irish branch of the World Ship Society in Cove about their recent visit to Greenwich. And we'll be talking to open water swimmers as the voting closes for the World Open Water Man of the Year. That's the Wowzers. You can still vote for the remarkable Steve Redmond of Seven Oceans Challenge fame. We head to the coastal town of Cove, where just a fortnight ago, the World Ship Society gathered in the Commodore Hotel. Seascapes was there and we talked to Oliver Hawes, Master Mariner, Seafarer and Tall Ships Captain, Captain Michael Coleman, in a year that saw the town commemorate the centenary of the Titanic. First, we hear from historian Vincent McMahon.
This year, we were very successful in opening the original White Star offices here in the old White Star building, from which those 123 passengers departed. It's now Titanic Experience, and I'm happy to say that I'm historian there. We have had a very successful year, and we concentrate mostly on that 123, and particularly at the moment on the 44 that survived. We're actually looking more closely at them. So this year, from the point of view of Titanic, it's been, as you know, 100 years. I was recently in Halifax, and in Mystic, where Bob Ballard has his new exhibition, which descends to the seafloor, and you picture yourself on the seafloor alongside the Titanic. But yes, Cove's connection with Titanic is dramatic, and the Irish connections with Titanic are even greater. I mean, built in Belfast by Irishmen. We had shipwrights from Passage West who worked on her in Belfast. We had the steam turbines developed by an Irishman. The ship herself sailed as her last port of call, being Queenstown, and 8 people got off here in Queenstown, well, 7 plus John Coffey, who jumped ship, and we're actually looking into those people who disembarked here in recent times, because some of them, the O'Dells, rented a car here from Johnson and Perrott's 100 years ago. I'm glad to say Johnson and Perrott's are still here, and we've recently procured some documentation confirming all of that.
Michael, you've all been on a recent trip to really, I suppose, one of the iconic parts of London in terms of the maritime, and that's Greenwich. And I think the stones in the street exude what went on there. It feels like it should be part of maritime history, maritime world history. I suppose if you shut your eyes, you can nearly hear Captain Bligh call for his crew.
Marcus, actually, that's very true. Greenwich, to a sailor and to ship lovers, is an iconic place. It is a suburb of London, but in fact, it's a town on its own. And the atmosphere around, to a sailor, is absolutely magic. It holds great, great maritime treasures. And of course, the principal treasure there is the Clipper Cutty Sark, which is now fully restored. She's a very, very old vessel now, well over 100 years old, and she suffered a calamity there about maybe 7-8 years ago when she went on fire during restoration. But she's now fully restored, and she's open to the public again, and she is an iconic vessel, and she is at the heart of maritime London, and to a sailor epitomises the very essence of what Greenwich is really. Greenwich, of course, straddles the meridian. It's the zero meridian between east and west. And another great treasure in Greenwich is the observatory on the hilltop. That observatory holds wonderful artefacts, but the most important of all, of course, is Harrison's chronometers. Sailors are all aware of the importance of a chronometer on a ship. In the old days, navigation could not be conducted without a chronometer. And Harrison, a humble carpenter, invented a chronometer. And all his original clocks are there. And believe it or not, fascinating to think, they are all working, they are all tick-tocking. And unlike the average clockmaster's shop, they all tell the same time. Wonderful to see them all there. Absolutely stunning to see them. But of course, one of the main attractions of our recent visit to London was to visit Shackleton's famous lifeboat. The James Caird, the Shackleton enthusiasts and indeed polar enthusiasts will be well aware of the tremendous voyage that Shackleton and his little lifeboat, after the crushing of the Endurance, after the living on the ice, they were left with no option but to seek help. This was in the days when there were no radios and no sat-navs and no modern communications, and when they ended up in Elephant Island, the only way to be rescued was to go off and cross the Antarctic Ocean on a tiny little boat. It's only 22 feet long, 6 feet wide, a tiny little boat. Our main focus was to see this boat. It's absolutely miraculous that she still exists, but she does, and she's in good order. She is kept now as a treasure in Shackleton's old alma mater, Dulwich College in South London. We had contacted the college a few months ago, and they agreed to show us the boat, and they received us extremely well over there, gave us great hospitality. Without question, this is the most important small boat in the world. And no other boat has ever even come close to navigating a voyage such as this. And from an Irish point of view, it is very gratifying to see that the Irish input. Remember, the crew of this boat was 6, but 3 were Irish. Shackleton himself was Irish-born, as was Tom Crean, and as was Timmy McCarthy from Kinsale. 3 Irish ran this boat on this journey. It is a tremendous little boat to see, and we all broke out in goose pimples when we saw it. It's absolutely wonderful to see it, to see what this little boat has achieved. Most ships and boats, if you look at them, you'll say, always, it's the human endeavour is the weakest link. They say most of the accidents that happen are human and human caused. If you see a big ship, the weak link is the crew, not the ship. But on this little boat, it's the reverse, because the boat, it looks so small and it looks so fragile. And you see the ocean she took on, the stormiest ocean in the world. It's the determination and the strength and the power of the crew that saw it through. And 3 of this crew were Irish. What fantastic history.
Also, I suppose, the fact that the carpenter built up the sides of it to get them through what they were going through. It's really man against nature at its finest. But it's also a very emotional trip, isn't it, Oliver, to go and see something like that in its home.
As Mick, our chairman, said, we were absolutely touched when we saw that the actual boat and the size of it, and when we were able to touch it and feel it and live in the environment that Shackleton had gone to school in before he went on his great voyages to Antarctica, it really was something that we'll never forget, because it's such a small boat, as Mick said. It's only 23 foot long, and to think that it still exists and that it was brought back from Antarctica in 1914, and it exists in the college that Shackleton went to school in today, and revered by the students. The president of the James Caird Society told us that it's amazing, he said, where this boat is kept, and they have a wonderful exhibition there, that they have never found any rubbish or anything on the ground, and that the students that pass through this hall every day admire this ship. And it must have an influence in their careers in the future.
The Dulwich College were presented with some documentation from the Royal Geographical Society in the last few years. And amongst it was a green flag with a harp on it. Now, they'd asked us to research here whether or not Mary Crean in Tralee could recall whether her father had anything to do with this flag. I brought a copy of it to her, but in fact she didn't think he had. But she did suggest that Shackleton, being from Leinster, and Leinster with the harp and the green, she reckoned that it was probably Shackleton's as distinct from her father's. But they haven't solved that one quite yet.
Last year we had a great visit up to northeast England, where, as Oliver already mentioned, we visited Gray's Archive, who hold the plans of Irish shipping vessels, and we visited, of course, Scott's Discovery, wonderful ship as well in her own right, and next year, who knows, there's lots of maritime history out there, you know, but maybe for the summer we think maybe that we're going to go down and pay our respects at the graveside of Tom Crean, our greatest polar explorer ever.
Our thanks to Captain Michael Coleman, Vincent McMahon and Oliver Hawes of the World Ship Society. What a pleasure to meet the members of the society and we'll keep you posted with their activities during the coming year.
Is it worth it? A new winter coat and shoes for the wife, and a bicycle on the boy's birthday.
It's just a rumour that was spread around town by the women and children. Soon we'll be shipbuilding.
Going to take me to task, but I'll be home by Christmas.
It's just a rumour that was spread around town. Somebody said that someone got filled in for saying that people get killed in the result of this ship. With all the will in the world, diving for dear life, when we could be diving for pearls.
The Unthanked Sisters at Other Voices a few weeks ago in Dingle, and Shipbuilding, written by Elvis Costello. This past year has been a remarkable one for long-distance and open-water swimmer Steve Redmond, who mastered the Ocean's 7 Challenge. What, we wondered on Seascapes, does the year ahead hold for him?
I don't know. Malady and me seldom meet. We're taking a month off. We're doing a little bit of work on the shoulders, and we're kind of regrouping. My friends, or so-called friends, are organising things for me next year. We hope to do the Shannon next year as a 7-day, 10-hour-a-day swim to kind of, a decent charity swim for a couple of charities, and bring on board a couple of celebrities every day to swim a couple of Ks with me, and go the whole length of the country and bring the open water swimming into the mainstream every day, have a report on media and get it out there. And with that, hopefully when we do that, as I say, we always say when instead of if. It's just to get it into the head early on in the game that you are crazy. We're going to try England Island, so a proper solo attempt England Island in August.
And of course, when the Fastnet Swim becomes that iconic swim that it's destined to become, magnificent facilities. I mean, when you look at the facilities in Skull alone.
Absolutely. It's the best. It's fantastic. The water there, a safe haven. You can train there all year round. Loch Eyne, the same thing. The expertise you have there, you can go to, you could go to 20 people and they'll tell you the tide, they'll tell you the best time to swim, and they will get you through it. Ireland, we always put ourselves down. We're absolutely a brilliant sea nation, and we don't really realize it. We're always looking outwards to America or someone else. We do it right here. We have the people here, and at last I think we're showing the people how it's done.
You can still vote for Steve Redmond as Wowza Man of the Year. Go to www.worldopenwaterswimmingassociation.com/2012-wowza-nominees. And you can also follow the campaign on Vote for Stephen on Facebook. At the recent gathering some weeks ago of long-distance swimmers from throughout the country, Seascapes had the opportunity to talk to one of this country's world-class open-water swimmers, Chris Bryan. He's planning his campaign for the next Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro.
I was kind of lucky. My neighbour was a swim teacher, Margaret Talty, and so all my family, all my older brothers and sisters, we all learned from a very, very young age, and look, we're going to set up like the community games and everything like that, and that's where I first got into it. I'm from Shannon, so from County Clare, we had the community games, and it was each county, and everyone went to Mosney, and it was a start-up, and I was actually in a competitive club myself, but I was beating all the kids from the competitive club. And it kind of made me stand up and say, look, I'm pretty good at this. So about the age of about 11 or 12, which is quite late really in swimming, I joined a competitive club. And like I even remember looking back, you know, those years ago and figuring out what time I had to go for the Olympics and being like, whoa, I'm going to be 22 in 2012. Oh, I wonder what I'm going to look like. And those years have just flicked through. Really, from such a young age, I kind of realized what I wanted. You know, everyone says they want to go to the Olympics, but it's almost every year then, and even looking back last year, looking at the 2012 Olympics and realizing, kind of thinking back to when I'm 12, I was looking at this, but, you know, imagine where you come from. The idea was so real. But, you know, this year I turned out, you know, I contracted the shingles virus the week of my Olympic qualifier, and I had a photo finish for the last Olympic spot, and I waited 6 weeks, and I was supposed to get a reallocated place, and in the end, they turned out giving a guy from Guam, the whole trying to include everyone, but I was still first reserve. Under bad circumstances, out of my control, but still looking back at the 12-year-old kid who all of a sudden said, hey, look, I'm pretty good at this, and wouldn't be amazing. And it's kind of crazy to look back at that and say where I've come. You know, I've trained in Ireland my whole life. There's always somewhat of a mentality that if you want to be good and want to compete internationally in a sport, you've got to leave the country. At the moment, I'm training like the Limerick High Performance Centre. I moved there when I was about 17. And like, you know, from that, I was ace in the World Championships last year. That was the best result in a World Championships in swimming in 9 years. That was in Shanghai in China. And Grainne Murphy as well, who trained in Limerick and trained in Ireland her whole life. Also, you know, qualified for Olympics this year. Sadly, also got glandular fever and didn't swim her main event. But, you know, she was always based in and she won senior European medals in 2009, which had never been done before in an Irish program. So it kind of shows you what's possible and with little dreams and, you know, kind of ticking away. And I don't know, ever since I was young and I realised this is what I want to do, I just did everything I could to make it happen.
Now, you're with a few colleagues here tonight from County Clare, representing the county, but it's a very special discipline, isn't it, to stay in the water? You've also met tonight a guy like Steve Redmond, who's really, I suppose, a pin-up figure in swimming for anybody who has an interest in being in the water.
Like, it's crazy how such a small country can almost get so big in the world term. Like, when I go abroad, there's so many people that kind of talk and ask me, people like about Sean Redmond and you know, Anne-Marie Ward and stuff like that. And, you know, sadly, this is actually my first time meeting him tonight. Like, the mentality, the Irish mentality is almost a hardy mentality. And it's almost great going abroad because you see these guys, and we say European, but really, we're not really European at all, you know. And we were brought up different. Since I was, you know, 4 or 5 years old, going to the beach, jumping into the ocean, didn't know any better. Like, like one of the coldest races in the circuit is Portugal, which is 17, 18 degrees, which it would never reach here in the summer. And for me, it's the bath, it's great. And everyone else is terrified of being cold. So, like, I remember since I was, you know, about 8, 9 years old, we were throwing jellyfish at each other. Went to a race in Turkey, and a lot of guys dropped out of the race because they were terrified of jellyfish. I went to Galway one evening, and I was kind of from a pool swimming background to start, and all these open water swimmers were there, and they were laughing at, you know, that pool kiddo. I was like, oh, I don't really like jellyfish. And, you know, the last thing I was going to do was not get in there. So, you know, I got in there and saw nothing about it, but that makes me so much stronger. The Irish mentality of the cold water, you know, the hardcoreness of it all, that, you know, it really does show worldwide the way the country makes us, you know. I was first reserve even with the shingles, and it is a sad story, but it kind of shows me and gives me confidence of what I really can do. And I've really only been at international open water for the past 2 years. I swam around Ireland for the past, you know, 7, 8 years, you know. But the international game is a completely different kettle of fish, but I've kind of see what I can actually do. And I have huge hopes for Rio. You know, I'm looking at least the top 8. And me talking right now, I'm confident that a medal isn't out of the question. So maybe when I was 12 years old, I didn't think about that. But everything gets so much more clear. And these are my goals. I kind of think, you know, shoot for the stars and you might land on the moon. So maybe I'll go for the gold, I'll get a bronze. And then at the end of the day, I look back and say, hey, you know, it wasn't too bad. So.
Next here on Seascapes to Julie Ann Lyons, who this year conquered the 10-kilometre Little Red Lighthouse swim near the George Washington Bridge in New York. She told Seascapes how her interest in open water swimming began.
I've always just loved the sea, always since I was a child. So I think what got me into it first was I thought I'd do the Liffey swim. And so I just was trying to figure out how do you go about doing the Liffey swim, and I was told that you have to join a swimming club in order to do the 4 qualifying swims that would qualify you to do the Liffey. So I went and I just joined a club that was swimming in a lane that I joined in the Markovich Pool, and I just said, what club will I join? And they said, well, you can join ILDSA, the Irish Long Distance Swimming Association. And so I said, okay, sign me up. And then I was insured to do the sea swims around Dublin Bay. and I loved them. And, you know, I just did, it started out where I just did the qualifying swims to do the Liffey because I thought that was such a cool swim to do. And then I got more into the actual swims themselves.
Now, one of the people we were talking about before, before we came down here, was a gentleman who did the Howth to Dunleary, Dunleary to Howth swim, which, if you live in Dublin, is quite a remarkable swim.
Yeah, unbelievable. And that's one of the things that I absolutely love about swimming around Dublin Bay, that you're swimming along and you're seeing like the two smokehouses, or you're seeing Docky Island or Howth, or so you might leave work and go for a swim and you realise you're in the middle of Dublin Bay and it's, you know, after work or before work or in the weekends, and you're just making the most of city life. Nobody really talks about the Channel swim. You know, Ned Dennison was introducing me to people who've done the Gibraltar swim, and people have done it in all different times, but then I just always ask, oh, have you done the Channel? And they're all casually, oh yeah, I've done the Channel too, you know, absolutely amazing.
So what about your New York swim? Tell me about how that came about and what it was like for you.
Well, I just started getting into slightly longer swims, so I was doing a 5k and then I did a 6k and then an 8k, and I was aiming for a 10k, and I was thinking, where else might there be interesting longer swims? And I love New York, I love Manhattan, so I just happened to be looking to see their open water scene in Manhattan, and I saw this 10k, and I was thinking, if I'm going to New York, I might as well go for a longer swim. And 10k would have been about my max. Obviously, I wasn't going to do the round Manhattan or anything like that. So I signed up for it in February for a race that was in September. So, you know, that was my goal then, my big goal. And I did the Lochgill 10k before then, like maybe a month before that. And so then I was kind of mentally knew I would be able for it. The tidal assist is really, really helpful. So that, another, that made it very doable as well. I did a much quicker time there than I did Lochgill. What I think about doing now is this Gibraltar swim, that just because the people that I swim with are talking about it, so they're infecting me with the bug, and talking to other people here isn't helping.
And there's great support, isn't there? People tend to forget that, whatever about the physicality of what you do in the water, a lot of it is down to your mental attitude, and it's a remarkable achievement in your head to do stuff like that. Maybe that's what keeps everybody so grounded.
Yeah, I mean, what people keep saying about those long swims, that like the Channel or something, is that it's something like 80% physical, or 20% physical preparation and 80% mental, which is incredible. And it makes me think, well, if it's only 20% physical, maybe I'd be able to do it. But I love the fact that people are all ages, all shapes and sizes. Everyone is so warm, so welcoming, so enthusiastic. Like, it's really quite a special group of people, I think.
Our final swimmer on this edition of Seascapes is a master mariner and tall ship's captain whom we've met down through the years on Seascapes. That man has the distinction of having captained the Asgard II, the Dunbrody and the Jeannie Johnston. He is Captain Tom McCarthy.
Yeah, I've gone from on top of the water to into the water. And I packed up seafaring a few years ago, and about 3 years ago I got interested in open water swimming. I joined the Sandy Cove Island Swim Club, and a fantastic organisation, fantastic group, and started doing the cold open water swimming. And this year I managed to do a relay of the English Channel, so I'm delighted with myself. It's a great adventure, and as good as any adventure I ever had on top of the water.
I hear you were one of the youngest fellows in the relay team.
Yeah, it's the first time in many years that I was called a garçon, because I was 59 years of age and the average age was 64, so I think we're the oldest group ever to relay the Channel, you know.
What kind of experience was that for you? Because a lot of fellas talk about about the physical side of it. It's much more the psychological side of it.
Yeah, well, what struck me about the swimming since I got involved, and I do a lot of pool swimming in the winter, is that some seriously good pool swimmers, they have a sort of an irrational fear of the sea, and obviously to me that wouldn't apply. So I'd have no fear that way. I mean, my swimming ability wouldn't be great, but I'd get into the sea no problem, and I'd get in any weather. And as a matter of fact, I was training in the Irish waters there from March, and maybe 10 or 11 degrees, and when I got over to Dover, I felt like swimming in soup in 16 or 17 degrees, and yet the Australian group that I swam with were suffering from hypothermia, so it is amazing how relative it all is, you know. It's absolutely phenomenal, and I mean, I'm a pleasure to be part of it in a very minor way, but I swim below there. Like this morning there now, there was numerous channel soul. It was done. I mean, what an achievement that is. And it's a pleasure to see these guys and to be part of it, and they're very welcoming, and my ability will be way down the line, but I can swim with them and I have fun with them. We'll have our teas and our coffees afterwards and our chats, and here we are tonight knowing for my celebrating all that thing. But those channel solos are amazing people, you know. I mean, outside of their training and their phenomenal achievements, they put huge work into it, the organisation of it. It's a very, very kind of locally run, you know, low budget, doing it on their own. And I mean, I often said to Ned, like, that the work I'd rated, that we really do appreciate it, the phenomenal love and spirit and time they have for the whole thing.
If you're taking part in charity swims into the new year, do please consult the Irish Water Safety website for a comprehensive list of do's and don'ts. And you can also find details on the Seascapes webpage, which is www.rte.ie/radio1/Seascapes. On Seascapes, we wish you a happy, prosperous and peaceful new year. No Seascapes next Friday night here on RT Radio 1. However, Seascapes, your maritime programme, returns on Friday the 11th of January, when we'll be talking to Daniel Nolan, the author of Clippers, the Ships That Shaped the World. We'll be featuring sailor David Kennefic on competing in the Figaro. And we look forward to an exciting year ahead right around our coastline and on our inland waterways. All that and much, much more here on Seascapes. So, until Friday the 11th of January, tight lines and fair sailing.